This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Next, you'll hear from the screenwriter of the movie The China Syndrome, Mike Gray, and from a Mary Knoll sister who visits and writes to death row inmates, Sister Marie Dolores Nassauer.
Guilt and innocence, they are a matter of degree. What is justice to you might not be justice to me.
I would like to say to the family, I regret the pain I've put you through, and I hope you can get over it someday. Mom and Dad, I love you. Take care. I'm ready. Those were the very simple last words of a young man named T.J. Jones. When arrested, he was an 18-year-old fast food cook. He and three other kids shot an old man they were attempting to rob. He was guilty. He said so. And like 67% of all death row inmates in Texas, he was a person of color and dirt poor. T.J. died on August 8, 2002. A college professor in Iowa, David Baldus, did a survey of 2,400 cases before the court in Georgia. The results of the study show, when the perpetrator is a person of color and the victim is white, the death penalty is prescribed 22% of the time. White felon, white victim, death penalty 8% of the time. White felon, black victim, death penalty 3% of the time. And black-on-black violence only rates the death penalty 1% of the time. Here is Kathy Golden with Mike Gray, the author of The Death Game.
Mike, when you were first asked to tackle this project, did you have your own particular feelings?
I have not been a death penalty opponent. My approach was to look at this thing. Does it work? Does it do what it's supposed to? Is it a deterrent? No. Turns out it's not a deterrent. In fact, the death penalty states have a higher crime rate than the non-death penalty states. We have 38 states with the death penalty. Not all of them use it. Take Texas, for example. Texas is the death penalty capital of Christendom, of course, and Harris County in Houston, they send more people to the death chamber in Houston than most countries. The crime rate there is terrible. So it hasn't been working for Texas. But when you're commissioned to do a book about the death penalty, your first stop is always Texas. They almost always have an execution underway down there. And the fellow that was in the crosshairs at that particular moment was Gary Graham, a street punk who had shot a bunch of people in a series of robberies, but he didn't happen to do the particular crime that he was sentenced to death for. The shooting took place in the Safeway parking lot, and this woman saw the shooting actually take place. In fact, she tried to stop it. She was a very courageous lady, a black school teacher in the parking lot. She looks up, and she sees this black teenager with a gun to the head of this white guy holding a bag of groceries, and she screams at him, don't. And the guy fires anyway, and the white guy staggers into the Safeway and dies right there, face down. The kid takes off across the parking lot, and this woman chases him. Even though she's got a couple of her own kids in the car, she chases after him. And right at the exit of the parking lot, the kid stops and looks straight at her for a split second with a gun still in his hand. You know, so it was incredibly courageous what this woman did. The cops take her down to the station. She gives him a description. She says he was thin, he was about so-so, and he had, you know, no facial hair and da-da-da-da-da. They show her five photographs, and four of them are fat-faced people with bushy hair, nothing like her description. There is one photograph, a suspect named Gary Graham, and she says that looks the most like him. Then they take her to a lineup, and none of the other guys in the photo show are there except for Gary Graham. There are four other different people plus Gary Graham. She reacts immediately and says, that's him. But on the way home, as the cop is driving her home, she says to the officer, I recognized him from the photograph. That's information that certainly should have been in the trial, but it turns out that Gary Graham got a lawyer, a fellow named Ron Mock, who at that time was one of the few black attorneys in the Houston criminal court system. And Ron Mock made his money on volume. Texas doesn't pay a whole lot of money to a defense attorney in a death penalty case. Indigent gets, you know, like the bare minimum. And Ron Mock was quite wealthy, drove a Rolls Royce and had a bunch of saloons in downtown Houston and so forth. And he did this by systematically losing cases as quickly as possible. Because if you're doing it on volume, you can't afford to call any witnesses on behalf of your client or cross-examine the government's witnesses. The only thing Ron Mock did was congratulate the government witness who ID'd his client for her courage and bravery. What he didn't bring up was the fact that there were two other eyewitnesses right there. The checkout counter lady and the box boy at Safeway both said, he's not the guy. The real guy was half a foot shorter. We know, we saw him, we watched him for 20 minutes, and Gary Graham is not the man. But by the time that information was brought to the fore, it was too late. Literally, too late. because they had passed a catch-22 called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And this was passed in the wake of the Timothy McVeigh bombing in Oklahoma City. And what they were trying to do was speed up the death penalty process so that we wouldn't see this business of interminable delays, guys like Gary Graham being on death row for, you know, 15 years, having a half a dozen dates with the needle and being able to escape from everyone at the last minute. And so the Effective Death Penalty Act says that even though you may have evidence that you were innocent, if you could have brought it up at your original trial and didn't, tough luck, mister. This train is moving on. And so the Supreme Court, on the basis of that technicality, simply refused to hear Gary Graham's witnesses, who had been trying to get themselves in front of a judge to just hear their story for nearly 8 years, and the courts had steadfastly refused. So I don't think there's any question among people who have really reviewed all the evidence in the case that Gary Graham was executed for a crime that he didn't commit.
Yeah, you might be the wrong color. Yeah, you might just be too poor. Justice isn't something just anyone can afford.
His name is Jimmy. He turned 38 last August, and he is serving out a 15 to 33-year sentence in Sing Sing Prison. He was born in upstate New York, but he's not sure who his mom was. He was taken in by a family and suffered all types of abuse. He ran away to Texas in his early teens and learned many skills. Jimmy was doing well. He was married, had two little girls, and was making good money operating a tow truck. But then his wife and one of his little girls were killed in a car accident. With his life turned upside down all over again, Jimmy came back to New York with little more than a Texas twang. He doesn't talk about why he ended up in prison. Years later, on a Wednesday night, December 12th, a couple of years ago, Jimmy and other Sing Sing inmates attending weekly mass were asked to pray for a man in Texas who was being executed at that very hour, Vincent Cooks. After mass, Jimmy told Mary Knoll's sister Elizabeth Roach that many years back when he'd first arrived in Texas, it was the same Vincent Cooks who saved him from a beating. Elizabeth then introduced Jimmy to the Mary Knoll sister who had been with Vincent Cooks at his execution, Marie DeLourdes Nassauer. Kathy talked with Marie, a Mary Knoll sister since 1947, about how she had first met Vincent Cooks.
How did your contact with Sing Sing come about?
All right. One day in the library, I saw a magazine that was Sisters Today. And in the back, I looked at the want ads. And there was an ad from this man called Michael Denson, who lived in Texas. And Michael has what he calls his Catholic death row ministry, looking for people to write to death row prisoners. So I wrote to Michael. And I said, yes, I would write to somebody. And finally, Michael answered me, and he says, I have a death row prisoner for you by the name of Vincent Cooks in Texas. So I wrote to Vincent, I think at least four or five times before he answered me. But I thought, I'm not going to let him get away with this.
No,
I know nothing about him. Nothing. Nothing, nothing. Michael doesn't say. He just says, this is his name, and this is the address. Finally, I get a letter from Vincent, and he said, I wasn't going to write to you, but because you kept insisting in writing to me, I'm going to write to you, and I hope we become friends. We really did. He was a delightful young man. He died at the age of 38. He was executed at 38. So we wrote, and about 6 months into the writing, he said, would you come and visit me? I had never been to Texas. I didn't know anybody in Texas. So I found this woman who was with us in Chile. Her name is Lois. So I wrote to Lois. She's in College Station. And she said, yes, by all means, come and stay with me, and I'll take you to the prison. So we went, and I had a visit of a couple hours with Vincent, met him for the first time. Then I went back to Texas four times to see him, and the last was the execution. He said to me, would you be with me at the end?
How did you manage?
How could I say no? I did, and I cried through the whole thing. He could have five people. I was there with his mother, his aunt, two brothers, and we were there to see him go into eternity.
Marie, yeah. What had he done?
From the first letter he wrote to me, he said, I am accused of the death of a police officer. Right. Usually they don't tell you. I'm still writing to some fellas that have never said why they're on death row. And then he told me his story, that it was a botched robbery. He and a couple of the fellas were going to hold up a supermarket in Dallas. And something happened, and the police officer was moonlighting as a security officer. He was bringing the money in or out with the manager of the store. And one of the three had a gun. and the police officer was shot. And Vincent said to me, I did not kill that police officer. But he's the one that was accused. I don't know what happened to the other two. He said to me, I will take responsibility for everything that I've done in my life. He was kind of, you know, uncontrollable, I guess, as a young fella. And he said, but I did not kill that police officer. So I went to the execution. It was December the 12th, just before Christmas.
Wow.
Something I will never forget, to see this healthy, huge fellow strapped down to this gurney. And he spoke. They bring a microphone down over them as they're on this gurney. It's very clinical. They're covered with a white sheet. You don't see much. You see one arm where all the drugs are going in. That's it. And he spoke to his mother, spoke to his aunt and his brother, and he spoke to me. He said, Marie, my pal. He always called me pal. Thank you for everything, he said. I didn't do much for him. Wrote to him, visited him.
Oh, but you did, Marie.
Yeah.
You did.
And he had dear family. His mother still calls me. They took me out to the prison. His mother and his brother came and picked me up in Houston and took me out to the prison. And because you come from afar, the prison gives you 8 hours, 4 hours for 2 days. So I sat with him for 4 hours each time. And they sat out in the parking lot because they were not allowed in with me. Not even his mother. I said to her, you know, I feel so bad that you people have to wait 4 hours for me. No, no, she said, I'm so glad that he's out of his cell and talking to you. And, yeah.
How did he face it? How did Vincent?
He was very quiet. I had said to him, you know, how are you going to react to all this?
Yeah.
No, he was very good. Thank God. If he had been agitated, I don't know what would have happened. And you stand there and you just stand behind the glass. There are no seats, no nothing. The chaplains had told us it would be over in maximum would be 6 minutes that you would be standing there. I cried. I cried through the whole thing. I was just, it was unbelievable. See this man killed before your very eyes.
How do we do that?
That's the question. And people, including Catholics, are still for the death penalty. And that is wrong. We have to think of the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. And that means you, me, these people, these criminals, and the state. The state doesn't have any right over our life. Only God, who created us, has the right to our life.
So are you for or against the death penalty? Let us know what you think. Log on to the Voices of Our World webpage, www.marynoll.org. There's a spot there for your feedback. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Mike Gray, Marie Dolores Nassauer, Joseph Onick, and Jerry Spence are just some of the voices of our world. Voices of Our World is a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. Our producers are Eleanor Ostrinsky and Kathy Golden. Our executive producer is Larry Rich. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Ani DeFranco's song Crime for Crime from the CD, Not a Pretty Girl, is available through Righteous Babe Records. www.righteousbabe.com. Jerry Spence's book, The Smoking Gun, published by Scribner, and Mike Gray's book, The Death Game, by Common Courage Press, are available on Amazon.com and at bookstores everywhere. If you'd like to receive a free 3-month subscription to Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, or you have questions about Mary Knoll or our show, just call 1-888-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-888-MARYKNOLL. If you missed a portion of the show, just catch us on Mary Knoll's website, www.marynoll.org. And please be sure to join us next time for more Voices of Our World.